I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, we present historical and contemporary examinations of Jewish food today. In the first part of the program, editor-in-chief of Tablet magazine Alana Newhouse makes her case for the 100 Most Jewish Foods from her new book of the same name, The 100 Most Jewish Foods, a highly debatable list. Then, in the second part of the program, journalist and editor of J, the Jewish News of Northern California, Sue Fishkoff, gives a compelling overview of the phenomenon of kashrut and the kosher food industry, including the more recent demands that kosher food meet ethical and environmental standards. But now, let's join Alana Newhouse at the JCCSF pop-up at Spark Social SF as she shares the 100 Most Jewish Foods, a highly debatable list.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. This is super fun. So what I thought I would do is give you a little window into how we came up with the book and how we developed the list and a little window into some of the entries, just four or five of them, and then you guys can ask me questions or yell at me. Okay. Sigmund Freud once said, "Jews and food, food and Jews, that's all there is." Not exactly. But after putting together this unfathomably rich collection, the salty, the sweet, the dense, the light, the beautiful, and the undeniably brown, stretching back over thousands of years of civilization and from every region of the planet, we believe the great father of psychoanalysis would agree with us. It is quite possible to view all of human history as unfolding between these two poles. This is not a list of today's most popular Jewish foods, or someone's idea of the tastiest, or even the most enduring. In fact, a number of the dishes on this list are no longer cooked or served with any regularity, at least not in the home kitchens or communal spaces where they originated. And the edibility of many others is, well, let's say it's up for debate. What's here instead are the foods that contain the deepest Jewish significance. The ones that... You're already fighting with me? Great. The ones that throughout the history of our people, however you date it, have been most profoundly inspired by the rhythms of the Jewish calendar and the contingencies of the Jewish experience. That many of them are also delicious is obvious and Darwinian. It is how they survived as long as they did. Most of the items on this list will be immediately recognizable. No one was going to leave out chicken soup or babka or shakshuka or matzah. But there are also dishes here that for many won't be familiar at all. Unhatched chicken eggs and jellied calves' feet, as well as recipes from around the globe and ones nearly lost to history. These are foods that were generated by a people that became many peoples, a tribe at once bound together by a shared tradition, but also separated by radically different host countries, cultures, politics, and influences. We found inspiration in this tension between what Jews share and what we don't. So with that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how we came to the list. So we run a magazine called Tablet Magazine. And about 5 years ago, a writer named Mark Tracy decided that he wanted to explore why Jews ate Chinese food on Christmas. And it turned out that there's enormous academic research is not surprised by this, I understand. the person who wrote his thesis on Manischewitz is not surprised that there's a lot of academic work on Chinese food and Jews. But it turns out that there are several books on the subject, most of which point out a few things. One of which was that we're talking about the melting pot primarily of the Lower East Side at the turn of the century, beginning of the 1900s, when there were three large ethnic groups living together: the Jews, the Italians, and the Chinese. The problem with the Italians was that they tended to put a lot of Christian stuff all over the walls, which made Jews nervous. The other thing is that they mixed meat and milk. Now, the Chinese don't have a ton of dairy in their diet, so there isn't the issue of meat and milk. What a bunch of academics also pointed out was they helpfully chop up the non-kosher stuff into tiny little pieces, so you don't really have to think about what it is. And the last thing, of course, is that most Chinese people are not, certainly the ones that were living on Lower East Side, are not Christian, so all of their restaurants were open on Christmas. So because of all of these things, the Jews frequented restaurants, Chinese restaurants, on Christmas. So Mark writes this article. I can't tell you how many millions of people read this article. It was like we had to like expand our server capacity for a week after we started writing, after we published it. And the crazy part was every single December, somebody on Reddit posts it, and it's like another bonanza. It's like I can't teach Americans the same story enough times. But a few years ago, I thought to myself, if Chinese food is a quintessentially Jewish tradition, what else would be on that list? And how, if we thought about, Tablet has put together other lists. We put together lists of the greatest Jewish films, the greatest Jewish songs, 101 great Jewish books. And I thought to myself, if we're putting together canons that represent our inheritance, we can't possibly leave out food. So with that challenge, we started to ask ourselves what would be on the list. And within, I would say, a few months, probably no more than 2 months, we had over 400 items in an Excel document. Now, a lot of those items are items that you would find obvious, items that you would expect. One of the first things we wanted to do, though, we wanted to challenge even the items that were familiar to people. We wanted you to look at them a little more deeply. So I'm going to give you a pretty well-timed entry right now, which is the entry for charoset, which is a food that is eaten on Passover during the Passover Seder. Passover is the most celebrated Jewish holiday in the world, reaching across the ever-widening denominational aisles to unite Jews in a shared sense of culture and history. For African-American Jews like me, the writer, a man named Shays Rishon, Passover feels ever more real, tangible. For us, the Seder plate isn't something symbolic of an event that happened to ancestors long ago in a country far, far away. It's about experiences that happened to our family, our grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, of whom we have photographs and maybe even have had the privilege of actually knowing in the country we actually live in. When it comes to culture and history, no food merges the two as deftly as the chunky concoction known as charoset, representing the mortar from which Jews form their bricks in Egypt. Gibraltarian recipes use real ground bricks, and Persian ones include 40 different ingredients for each of the years the Jews spent in the desert. While the charoset of African-American Jews consists of the slave crops of pecans, cocoa powder, figs, and sugarcane. No matter what recipe you use, charoset pays homage to our ancestral story of slavery while representing a unique expression of Jewish diasporic experiences from everywhere around the globe. So we knew that we wanted to start to get really challenging and deepening entries for the foods that we knew were going to be on the list. But then we also started to realize that there were a lot of foods. I mean, if I really wanted to make a list of the 100 most famous foods from the Lower East Side, I could have done that because there are enough of them. But we didn't want to do that. We wanted to do a list that spanned the globe and that spanned history. And one of the first entries that we got was an entry for adafina, which is a stew that Jews who lived on the Iberian Peninsula after the Inquisition, where they were forced to, most people were forced to convert. They converted either willingly or under duress. But a lot of them wanted to maintain their Jewishness. And one of the ways that they maintained their Jewishness was in secret by making something called adafina, which was a Sabbath stew. And the challenge for them was that the authorities would actually have the servants monitor kitchens of the homes of people. And if they found out that those homes were either not cooking on the Sabbath or not using salt pork, which is the sort of famous pork of the region, they would know that those people were secretly trying to stay Jewish. So for me, this entry ended up becoming really a rooting entry for us because it proved the thing that I felt, which is that you cannot argue to me that food is not actually a way that people express who they are. There are people who have expressed who they are via food and put themselves in danger to do so. So for me, that kind of created a sense of value to the list. And then we went on and we added all sorts of other things. And the only last part of the project that I'll talk about before I throw it out for questions is one of the things that was very important to me was that we did not number the list. Because how was I going to judge? Like Adafina against chopped liver? I guess I understand that more Jews know about chopped liver and have tried it, but none of us sacrifice our lives for it. So how do I put a value on that? So what I wanted to do is I wanted to put them all on the... So on the original site, we put them all on the same table. We shot them all on this exact same day. So we had to source all 100 foods, bring them all together, cook them, photograph them individually, and then photograph them all on the same table. So we had this spreadsheet on the wall where we would check off when the food came in, when it was photographed, when it... And it was a very, very cold November day in New York. And I went to the kitchen to make myself a cup of tea. And I was sitting there with my tea, and Stephanie Butnick, who's the deputy editor who worked on the book with me, looked at me and said, "When you're done, can you pass me that tea bag?" And I said, "Sure." And then somebody else from across the room said, "Guys, just leave it on the counter. I'm going to come make myself tea, too." All of a sudden, we looked at each other. We said, "The used tea bag. I can't believe... we didn't include it. This is so upsetting because we're here. We're done. We're shooting the 100 foods." And then, like some weird reverse Hanukkah miracle, it turned out that we only had 99 foods. It has to do with Excel and the way that it numbers things. It doesn't matter. The point is that we actually were missing a food. So we took out the used tea bag that we all shared. And that is, in fact, the tea bag that was photographed and is in the book. So that's my favorite story. There's only one entry for deli, because that's another one where I could do the 100 most popular deli, Jewish deli foods, right? And the person who wrote it is a guy named David Sachs, who, if you haven't actually, if you're interested in deli, David Sachs wrote the most amazing book about the history of Jewish deli. It's just fabulous. And I called David and I said, "Okay, David, give me the one entry." And he said to me, "Are you out of your mind? I can't, no, I'm not going to pick, it's like picking between pastrami and salami. It's like picking between children. I can't do it." And I said, "Okay, but you have to pick one." So he said to me, "Fine, I'm going to pick one and I'll send you my entry." So I think David's off making a hard choice. Instead, what he did was he sent me in an entry that said deli, which then allowed him to list every single one of his favorites inside of the entry, because he just would not let it go. But the truth is that the pastrami sandwich is iconic and really probably deserves its own entry. I mean, I think it deserves its own entry, but it just didn't work out.
Earlier today, you said that you didn't want challah to be included, so I'm wondering, that felt very controversial at the time. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So the directive that challah comes from is directive to have lecha mishnah, which is a bread on the Sabbath. But because that was a directive, Jews all over the world throughout history have all developed their own Sabbath breads. What you are eating when you have challah is a bread that originated in Germany. It's quite good. It's delicious. I know why it's popular. It's also very specific, and the only reason why it's so popular today is because of the vagaries of the last 100 years and where Jews landed up. But if you look in the book, there's a whole entry for Yemenite Sabbath breads. And the truth is that if we were going to be intellectually and historically accurate, the entry would be for Sabbath bread, not for specific Sabbath breads, because we should really respect all of the traditions of all the Jewish communities. And I mean, I happen to think what the French used was like much better, but it doesn't matter. the point is that what happened was everybody on staff argued that I was getting too academic about it, and that part of the book was to... We wanted the book to be familiar to people. We wanted the book to actually feel like it reflected the foods that people feel close to. So I didn't want to kind of esoteric it out of existence, basically.
What happened to the knish?
It's under potato.
I would love to get some insight onto whatever the debate that went on internally to whether to add bacon to the list.
That was a big one. Okay, so that was sort of a two-step conversation. It was a two-part conversation, which took many months, but there were two ideological parts to that. The first one was, in the very, very beginning, we were trying to figure out what our definition of foods that have Jewish significance were. And one of the things that was clear to us was that the way that I see it, there are four boundaries on Jewish food. Every cuisine emerges from boundaries. Most cuisines emerge from geographical boundaries. Jews don't have that, right? But we have four boundaries. The four boundaries are basic kashrut, so not mixing meat and milk, and no shellfish, no pork. Not cooking on the Sabbath or holidays. Not having leavened bread on Passover. And the fourth is that, like, we had a bunch of neighbors who hated us, right? So it's within those bounds that Jewish cuisine and the creativity that creates Jewish cuisine emerges. When you look at that, you realize that you simply cannot talk about the light without the dark. You can't understand what Jewish food is without understanding what it could never be for so many people. And, you know, finally, we understood that... as the writer of the piece says, it's like trying to conceive of Jewish food without treif is like trying to imagine Harry Potter without Voldemort. The narrative doesn't work. And then narrowing it down, the book actually has it as treif, and the site has it, it was bacon on the site. So when we did the book, because the book was appealing to an audience that might have been wider, we actually made it a more conceptual entry.
Wow, this is amazing. I just want to say, first of all, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm curious to know, this book has been out now for about a month, and I'm curious to know how it's been received across cultures with other Jewish communities.
It depends on where. So, for example, we have a bunch of dishes from around the globe. So, for example, we have an incredibly... literally, it's the most beautiful dish in the book, is a dish called Melita, which is a dish made by the Jewish community in India. And they are so excited because they never see Indian contributions in larger reference books about Jewish anything. Similarly, Fludny, which is a Hungarian dessert, which was... presented by this just amazing Hungarian baker. So the specific communities that are represented, the Syrian community, I'll be honest, I did look into it and didn't find a lot of uniquely British Jewish food, which may say something about England in general, but not every single community is represented. The ones that are very, very excited. The ones that aren't, are less excited.
I will ask the last question. What is the item, if you think back, is there like one thing you really wish, other than changing challah to Sabbath breads, like what do you feel like, ugh, that was such a miss? Is there anything?
No, I do think that somebody in another event came up to me with the best idea ever, which is that she said to me, when the book goes into reprint or when you go into paperback, you should actually add a page for the 101st, which you would let people write in their own. And when she said that, I was like, ah, that's the best idea. I'm so mad. So it's not a food, but it's actually the idea that you'd let people make their own contribution.
That's great. Thank you so much,
Thank
Alana.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Editor-in-Chief of Tablet Magazine, Alana Newhouse, whose new book is The 100 Most Jewish Foods, a highly debatable list. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Let's return to the program with journalist and editor of J, the Jewish News of Northern California, Sue Fishkoff, whose book is Kosher Nation, Why More and More of America's Food Answers to a Higher Authority. And now joins Sue Fishkoff on stage at the JCCSF.
This book called Kosher Nation, which is a little bit odd when you know more about me. I've never kept kosher. I'm not an observant Jew. I'm religious, which we all know the difference between religious and observant, right? And some people said to me, why are you writing a book about kosher food? That's such a niche topic. So few Jews keep kosher. And yet, when you ask any Jewish person about their family, their parents, their grandparents, everybody has some kind of kosher story. Like, you know, in our house when I was growing up, we could have shrimp cocktail, but not ham. And my parents would let us have pepperoni pizza, but only on Sundays and only in the basement and on paper plates. And my favorite story was a woman. I was speaking at a Jewish Federation event in Ventura last month, and everyone was sharing their stories of how their family, you know, their family's interpretation of kashrut. And this one family kept kosher. They kept a kosher home. They had separate meat and dairy dishes. Everything was done correctly. They had a special cabinet, their treif cabinet, where the dishes and cups were kept for when they brought non-kosher food into the house. They didn't want to mess up their kosher dishes. But all of the plates and cups that were kept in the treif cabinet were chipped and broken. And this was really interesting. So as they were eating non-kosher food, they were reminding themselves that they were chipping away at their Jewish values. And isn't that interesting? So even though they consciously decided at certain times of the year we're bringing in a pizza or Chinese food, they wanted their children to be aware that they had boundaries as Jews and that this was a Jewish decision that they were not making, right? So there was still a Jewish conversation about it. 25 years ago, kosher food really was the province of the country's very small minority of Orthodox Jews, and they lived in their neighborhoods and they ate in their kosher restaurants. And today, it is huge. It's the fastest growing part of the American food industry. How did this happen? I want to take you back to 1972. When a TV commercial first aired in America, and this is the Hebrew National hot dog commercial. We all know it. Uncle Sam is standing there, and he's about to bite into a hot dog, and a voice comes down from heaven saying, watch out when you eat hot dogs. Don't you know what they put in that stuff? There could be chemicals and additives and flavorings. But don't worry, the voice from heaven says, this is a kosher hot dog, and we answer to a higher authority, right? So something in that message, that kosher food answers to a higher authority, penetrated the American consciousness. And that message resonates today, 35 years later. Survey after survey shows that most Americans believe kosher food is healthier, safer, more pure, and of higher quality, and they're willing to pay good money for it. That's why kosher food today is the largest segment of the American food industry. Up to 40% of all the products for sale in the typical American supermarket are kosher certified. And we're counting everything from chicken to cereals to jams to aluminum foil to sponges to household cleansing items that are used in the kitchen. If you don't keep kosher, and I have a suspicion that some of you in this room don't keep kosher, go home and look in your pantry and look at cans and boxes and look for the little circle U or the star K or just a K. The generic kosher symbol, you will be shocked at how much of the food you own and the food you see in the supermarket that you don't even think about kosher is kosher. Well, how did this happen? Why is up to half of all the food sold in America kosher certified when Jews are only 1.5% of the population and very few Jews keep kosher? Probably about 15% of Jews keep kosher. Who's buying all this food? And why are so many food manufacturers paying up to $100,000 a year for kosher certification? So first, let's get into who's buying all this food. Most people who buy kosher food don't know they're buying kosher food, right? You pick up your Heinz ketchup, your Coca-Cola. You don't pick it up because it's kosher. It just happens to be. But there are still about 13 million what we call regular kosher consumers in this country, 13 million people who buy kosher food on purpose. Why do they do it? About a million of them keep kosher, so that leaves another 12 million. Many of them do it for dietary reasons. They might be lactose intolerant, right? There are 50 million Americans, 50 million Americans who are lactose intolerant. 90% of all Asians are lactose intolerant, 75% of African Americans. And I've been in stores and seen mothers from those ethnic groups who are looking for kosher certification without a D. Any kosher food that has dairy product in it has a D for dairy. If it has kosher certification with no D, it means there is absolutely no dairy product, no lactose in it. It wasn't even made in a factory where milk products were permitted. So for millions and millions of lactose intolerant Americans, they might look for kosher food. Religious groups other than Jews, Seventh-day Adventists are one religious group, and Seventh-day Baptists who keep away from unclean meat in the Old Testament. They will only buy kosher meat. Muslims. Many Muslims will buy kosher meat when halal meat isn't available. And that's a dispensation. The imams say you may, it's not a good thing, but you may buy kosher meat if you can't find halal meat. As more halal food is being sold in this country and as Muslims are becoming more strict, fewer and fewer of them are buying kosher meat, but you've still got 6 to 7 million Muslims in this country. So that's a big market for kosher meat. You've got vegetarians who are looking for kosher food that has either the D symbol, meaning there's absolutely no meat, only dairy, or the PARV symbol, neutral food, that has no meat or dairy. So a lot of vegetarians will look for kosher certification as well. Jews who are not observant, who don't keep kosher, will very often buy kosher food for Jewish holidays. And this is a funny thing, and I'm guilty of that. If I'm going to a Shabbat dinner at somebody's house, I will look for kosher wine. Why? Even if the people don't feel kosher, it's kind of like an inchoate gut feeling that it's the right thing to do. It's as if in this country, among liberal Jews, kosher or keeping kosher isn't necessarily a commandment from God that you have to obey all the time, but it can be a mark of membership in the tribe, a signal of Jewish ethnic identification. So if you're going to a simcha, you're going to a Jewish holiday table, you want to bring the kosher wine and you want to have kosher food, even if the rest of the time you don't keep kosher. So we see a lot of non-observant Jews buying kosher food at Jewish holidays, especially Passover. For the ethnic Jewish food manufacturer, the makers of matzah and wine and gefilte fish, they do half their business every year in the 2 weeks before Passover. So you see, the kosher food market has grown for a variety of reasons. Very quickly, for those of you who don't know what kosher food is, the first thing to know is that it's not food that's been blessed by a rabbi. And many people believe that that is what kosher food is. There are rabbis crawling all over the factories that make kosher food, but they are not proclaiming any blessings. They are acting as policemen in those factories, not as priests, just making sure that all the paperwork is in order and everything's done the way it should be done. So kashrut, which is the Hebrew word for the kosher dietary practice, kashrut is a whole network of laws and practices about how Jews are supposed to eat. And this whole system is derived from very, very few laws in the Torah. Just a handful of actual laws are in the Bible. And they're very rudimentary. You can't eat these animals. You can eat these animals. Don't mix milk and meat. And just there are about 6 rules that come from Torah. The rest of this enormous network of kosher laws have been developed by rabbinic commentary over the last 1,500, almost 2,000 years. So it's really something that's in development and changing as time goes by. For example, in the Torah, it says, you may not cook a kid, a baby goat, in its mother's milk. And from that, we have derived all our laws about what does it mean that you cannot cook a goat in its mother's milk. Can you only not cook an animal in its own mother's milk? And what about chicken? Yes, well, now we've decided we can't mix chicken with milk either, even though that's not a mammal. And if you're not mixing meat and milk, does that mean you mustn't have them at the same meal? Does it mean you can't have them on the same plate? Does it mean you have to have separate plates for meat and for milk? See, the rabbis have had centuries to figure out how to become stricter and stricter with all these original concepts that were outlined in the Torah. It's interesting. Kashrut, or the kosher food system, is not the only system of sacred eating. Many, many religions have a system of sacred eating. Ours, however, is the oldest to have survived untouched in its original details into the modern age. So how we plant our food, how we harvest it, how we slaughter animals, how we prepare and cook, how we eat, the blessings we say, all of this is laid out in strict laws and traditions that have been developed over thousands of years. It's almost as if Jews are hardwired to link our food choices to moral, political, and religious values. It's no coincidence that there are so many Jews active today in the organic movement, in the local food movement. The world of kosher certification, what does that mean? You've got an apple in your hand. You don't need a rabbi to tell you that apple is kosher. It is or it isn't. And that's how people ate into the 19-teens, into the 1920s. Virtually all the food that we ate in our homes came in its raw form. You always had your kosher butcher, right? And you'd have your kosher baker. But the rest of the food you prepared in your home and you knew what the ingredients were. As soon as you take that apple and you chop it, you cook it, you can it, you process it, then you have to be aware of what was going on in the factory, what other foods were available in the factory, was there lard used in this applesauce? You have to make sure all the flavorings and chemicals in that applesauce came from factories that also had kosher certification. So kosher supervision is a 20th century invention that's tied to the rise of the industrial food system. It's tied to the rise of factory processed foods. If there were no factory processed foods, all we'd need is a rabbi standing over by the shochet and the kosher butcher to say the meat is okay, and the rest of it you'd be cooking at home. So the very first product to get national kosher certification was Heinz vegetarian baked beans, and this was in 1923 when the Orthodox Union, which is the organization of Orthodox congregations in America, decided that there was too much factory processed food being produced. Jews were confused. They were all asking their local rabbis to tell them what was in this cereal, what's in the Borden's condensed milk, you know, what's in the Crisco, they don't know. And you can't keep going to the local rabbis. And the Orthodox Union came up with this idea, let's invent a symbol, a manufacturing symbol that we will put on kosher processed foods that will be recognizable to Jews around the world. Something national, something international that says, this is kosher, you don't have to ask your rabbi. It was a new concept. It took them a year to find a company that would agree to do it. Heinz Company agreed to do it. And then it took them almost a year to figure out what kind of symbol. The original symbol that the Orthodox Union wanted to put on the can was very Jewish. There was a Star of David involved. And Heinz said, we don't want to frighten away our non-Jewish customers. Let's not be so Jewy about it. So they came up with the idea, our name is the Orthodox Union. We'll make a U with an O around it. The Gentiles will not be frightened. And anyone who's Orthodox will understand, aha, it's the Orthodox Union. It's good enough. So it's interesting that that's how kosher certification started, as kind of, I wouldn't call it a subterfuge, but let's call it subtle, at a time when American food manufacturers were afraid of scaring off the non-Jewish public. Today, with 40% of all the food in this country kosher certified, it's almost impossible to get a new food item on the market if it doesn't have kosher certification. Because in this country, American food manufacturers see the kosher symbol as a mark of quality on their food, right? So the whole paradigm has shifted. Today, the Orthodox Union alone works in 80 different countries. They have 5,000 mashgiachs, which are kosher supervisors, working in their plants all around the world. They certify 500,000 different food items, and that's only one, the largest, of more than 1,000 separate kosher certifiers that are working today in America. There are more than 1,000 different individuals and agencies that give kosher supervision. So I spent a year for my book. I wanted to see how is this kosher food produced. And I like to go on the road and see what goes on behind the scenes. And I'm entranced by factories, right? I want to see what's going on behind the scenes of factories. So I got some kosher supervisors, mashgiachs, to allow me to go with them. I went to the Tropicana orange juice factory outside Tampa, Florida, 3 weeks before Passover to see how the Tropicana plant closed down its entire production line for 12 hours in the middle of the night to kosher it for Pesach, to make it kosher for Pesach, because regular orange juice has a lactose ingredient in it, which is not permissible during Passover. They have to change the ingredients, change all the lines. They had to blowtorch all the huge 50,000-gallon steel canisters, change all the conveyor belts. And this is a major international corporation agreeing to shut down production for 12 hours a year. I mean, imagine the millions of dollars in business that they are losing so that they can put a P, kosher for Passover, on their orange juice for 2 weeks of the year, right? It's really interesting. I went to see Manischewitz flour, the journey of Manischewitz flour. The Manischewitz matzah factory, they're the world's largest producer of matzah, is in Newark, New Jersey. And their kosher for Passover matzah, the flour itself has to be watched from the time that it is ground, from the wheat kernels ground into flour. And I went out to the family flour mill in western Pennsylvania, again in the middle of the night. All the great work of kosher food production takes place in the middle of the night. So I'm there at 2 in the morning when the tanker truck arrives and it's cleanly washed. And this was I think it had a 45,000-gallon tanker truck that was taking the flour from western Pennsylvania to Newark, New Jersey. The rabbi, this little rabbi, was crawling with his flashlight all through the tanker truck to make sure it had all been dried out, and he had his little drying cloth with him because no water can touch the flour in order for it to be kosher for Passover. The water and the flour can only be in contact for less than 18 minutes before the matzah is baked. So the tanker truck itself had to be completely dry. And then the rabbi watched as all the flour was poured in, and he sealed it up tight as a drum and put his special yellow twisty ties on it with his special signature. And then the trucker drove all the way to Newark, and we drove with him for 3.5 hours. And when we got to the factory, another rabbi was waiting there, and he made sure the seals hadn't been broken. I mean, it's incredible the amount of energy and time and care and thinking of these tens of thousands of kosher supervisors working in factories all around the world to create this food is just mind-boggling. I went to China. China is the fastest growing producer of kosher food and kosher food ingredients in the world. Half of all the food exported from China is kosher. It's all going to the United States and Israel. Most of it is very tiny chemical ingredients. You'll have an entire factory employing 1,000 people that makes one chemical preservative for Mazola corn oil back in America. So, and another factory that makes another flavoring, and another factory that makes the dye that gives it its color, right? So most of the kosher products in China that are produced in China are food ingredients. But today, more and more, even in the last 2 years, more and more snacks, finished products, chocolates, kosher chocolates. Now even kosher milk is being produced in China. When you think about the food safety scandals that have occurred in milk in China, think the kosher supervisors better be keeping a very close eye on what's going on there. And it's interesting that the Chinese people that I encountered in the factories, the managers and the workers, were all very proud of the kosher certification, and not just because it gave them access to the lucrative foreign market, but because of all the food safety problems in China, they were proud to be working in a factory where they felt food standards were upheld. It was really a point of pride. And of all the factories that I visited, I never saw such pride in work as among the workers and managers in the factories in China that I visited.
You're listening to journalist and editor of J, the Jewish News of Northern California, Sue Fishkoff, whose book is Kosher Nation, Why More and More of America's Food Answers to a Higher Authority, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
When you hear about the global kosher food industry and what I've described, obviously there's a lot of money involved, right? It's a huge, huge multi-billion dollar industry. And where there's money, there's corruption and there's fraud. And I had a lot of fun in my book tracing down some of the great, great stories of kosher fraud in years past. There was a lot of publicity 2 years ago and over the last 2 years around agriprocessors, the kosher slaughterhouse in Postville, Iowa, that was raided by Homeland Security for hiring illegal aliens and underage workers, and the manager of the factory, the CEO of the factory, is now serving a 27-year sentence for financial fraud. But you know what? That is only the latest example of a long history of corruption and fraud in the meat industry in general, as well as the kosher meat industry. The kosher, you know, the kosher meat industry is just part of the meat business. And any of you who've read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair knows it's a dirty business. It's a low-paid business, and not much has changed in 100 years. Some fraud is unconscious. There was about 15 years ago, a rabbi from the Orthodox Union found a kosher label on Fuji film coming from Japan. And they called up the company, called up Fuji, and said, you know, we don't give kosher supervision to you. Why are you using our symbol? And the owner of the company was very apologetic. It was a completely innocent mistake, sort of. He said, our marketing people, whom we pay a lot of money, told us that if we put a kosher symbol on our product, it will sell better in the United States. Those kind of stories happen all the time. Some of the incidents are of fraud are not so innocent. And again, we return to the kosher meat industry. 100 years ago, there was something in the Brownsville section of New York called the Kosher Meat Wars of the 1890s. And we had rabbis in the Bronx and in Brooklyn assassinating each other on the streets of New York for the pleasure of who gets to control kosher production in which corner of which neighborhood. Rabbis locking each other in meat freezers. There was a case in Paterson, New Jersey in 1906 where the poor rabbi who was hired by the Jewish community to come in as the overall kosher supervisor, the mashgiach, he said, all the shochets, all the kosher butchers in town, none of them will show me their knives. I'm supposed to make sure that they're all sharp, and they locked me in the meat freezer, and they do it all the time, and nobody gives me any respect, and how can I do this for $5 a week? So this was a big case, and it went to court, and the community hired another rabbi who came down from Buffalo, and he got into a big fight with the first rabbi in the synagogue, which did very little to enhance the reputation of kosher food in Paterson, New Jersey, in 1906. 1902, in New York City, we had the Great Jewish Housewives Kosher Meat Boycott of 1902. There were at that time 1,500 kosher butchers in New York City. 1,500 kosher butchers in New York City. One night in May of 1902, they all decided to raise the price of their meat from 12 cents a pound to 18 cents a pound, a 50% increase. The next day, 20,000 Jewish women were on the streets of New York, the Lower East Side, Harlem, and the Bronx in the Jewish neighborhoods, breaking windows of the kosher butchers, setting the meat on fire, accosting patrons coming out of these places, throwing their meat into the gutter, getting into truncheon fights with the police. They called out the New York PD. The riots went on for a couple of days. Hundreds of women were arrested and carted off in the paddy wagons. And similar things happened again in New York and in Philadelphia and in Chicago throughout the pre-war period. These riots of women against kosher butchers. In 1914, poor Bernard Braff, who was a kosher poultry wholesaler in New York, was accused by his competitors of price cutting and undervaluing his kosher poultry. And he was assassinated. And the The assassins, it was a team, were brought into court, and they said they were paid $4,200 by 100 other kosher butchers who had gotten together to raise the money to kill off their competitor. I mean, this was a rough world. Even into the 1960s, there was a man called Rabbi Morris Katz, Katz with a C, from St. Paul. And he was tasked with going around to all the kosher sausage and salami and processed meat plants of the Midwest to see what the heck was going on there. And he did his investigation for about a year and a half. He would show up at these kosher meat processing plants in the middle of the night, and he would watch as the trucks pulled off to the back landing docks and would unload non-kosher meat from the same factories that these manufacturers owned 30 miles away, 50 miles away. You'd own a kosher factory and a non-kosher factory, and you'd bring the meat from the non-kosher slaughterhouse into the processing plant to make kosher salami because it's cheaper. It's money, right? He estimated, this Rabbi Katz, in the report that he finally issued to the VOD, the Rabbinic Council of the Midwest, he estimated that 80 to 85% of the kosher meat products sold in this country were completely non-kosher. This was 1961. And he was lambasted by the Rabbinic Council, and he has this all in his book, not because of what he had uncovered, but because he was destroying what for them had become a very lucrative business of giving hashgacha, of giving kosher supervision to these factories. So this has been going on for a long time. Our situation today, I would argue, is much better regulated. I mean, what with the food safety laws, as well as the immediacy of communication through the internet and security mechanisms that are in place today in factories and retail stores, I would say that we have much less corruption and fraud going on today than even a generation ago. So that's something to think about. If Judaism has changed America's food industry, so has the American experience changed the way that Jews practice kashrut, right? Being in America, Judaism is different in America because of the freedoms in this country. Well, Jews never had an outside society forcing them to be Jews, nor did we have internal religious authorities laying down the law for us the way we did in Europe. Jews in this country have been pretty much free to decide what they want to do. And that's true of kashrut, of kosher laws as well. So kosher practice has always been different in this country. What does that mean? Let's take 110 years ago, the turn of the last century, when Russian Jews were pouring into this country. More than 1.5 million Jews came to this country from the Russian Pale of Settlement, from Russia and Eastern Europe. And they were eager to assimilate, integrate into American society as quickly as possible. The kosher food laws were set up in order to separate out Jews from the nations around them, right? If you can't break bread with your neighbor, you're not going to marry his daughter, right? So Jews eat together in order to keep themselves separate. This is the argument, and it is one of the major arguments for kashrut. There are other arguments as well that I get into in my book. So when Jews came to this country, they did not want to be separated out, and overwhelmingly, in the early 1900s, the 19-teens, into the 1920s, very few Jews kept kosher. Only the most ultra-Orthodox, because they wanted to integrate. By the time their children were born, in the early 1920s, a little bit more comfortable in American society, they started to create these American inventions like the kosher-style deli. Something that came about in America. And kosher-style deli, we chuckle at it. We say, oh, it's not really kosher. It's very, very Jewish. All the iconic foods of the Jewish people of Eastern Europe are served in the kosher-style deli. And at least in the early years, you would keep the milk and the meat separate. They would, even today, if you look at many kosher-style deli menus, you'll see one side of the menu has the meat products and one side of the menu has the milk products. But as years went by into the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, slowly the waiters would start to bring you cheese if you wanted it with your hamburger, and if you want it cooked together, okay, they might do it. And today you can go into kosher-style delis and see things like the Reuben sandwich, which has become a quintessential Jewish sandwich, which has a dairy product, right? You've got your cheese melted on your meat, and it's become part of our lexicon of Jewish food in this country. right? So again, it's Jewish, but not kosher. Similarly, through the 1930s and 40s, conservative Jews invented this thing called eating out. You say eating out to a Jew and you know what it means, something very different. What it means is you keep a kosher kitchen at home, and outside your home, you don't eat kosher. Or maybe you eat kosher, or you can set your own laws. And this has become accepted practice today for many increasing number of Reform Jews who are becoming more interested in kashrut, are keeping kosher homes or kosher-style homes. This is a new thing that's been happening in America as well. And then eating separately out. And they say, again, this is a Jewish decision that we're making. We're making a statement that I have a Jewish home, but outside my home, I'm also part of American society. By the 1970s and 80s, a new generation of liberal Jews did not feel threatened by kashrut the way their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents did. 100 years ago, if you kept kosher, it set you apart as an Orthodox Jew, as somebody who was not willing to merge with the rest of America. But by the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, again, a younger generation of Jews are looking, just as they're looking to prayer and to worship and to mikvah and to the whole host of Jewish rituals for meaning and mining them for their spiritual potential, so are today's young Reform Jews and secular Jews saying, hey, there might be something of value in a dietary practice that does not permit me to eat anything the heck I want. The politics of food are very trendy, very popular in America today. More and more Americans are concerned with where their food comes from, whether the workers were paid a living wage, whether the ground is contaminated with pesticides and chemicals, whether the animals were kept humanely, whether the chickens are cage-free or free-range. There's a big difference there. And as these interests have become part of the terminology of today's food activists, they've been adapted by Jewish food activists combined with the Jewish values of kashrut, both as a self-discipline and as a way of merging ethics with our food choices. Ever since the agriprocessors scandal at the kosher slaughterhouse 2 years ago, there's been tremendous conversation in all Jewish circles across the denominational spectrum. It was slower to arrive in Orthodox circles, but that same conversation is going on today about, we have in Judaism laws about ethics. We have in Judaism laws about how you're supposed to treat your fellow human being, how you're supposed to treat your animals, how you're supposed to treat the earth. We also have laws about food, kosher food laws. Should we bring the two together? Should they remain separate? How far can we expand the definition of kosher food? The word kosher means proper or fit to eat. How far should we, as 21st century American Jews, expand our understanding of what is fit and proper to eat? And is that a Jewish decision? An American decision? A human decision? Or does it matter what we call it? So very, very interesting innovations and creativity is going on today in the world of kosher food, and that's where the conversation belongs. Kashrut is really the original mindful eating practice for those of us who are interested in paying attention to what we eat. And as Jews, as American Jews, we've always known that the food we put in our mouth has a lot to say about who we are and what we think is important. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say. That's pretty much what my book is about. Thank you. A question you were asking me before about kosher meat.
Right. What is the difference between kosher and glatt kosher?
Kosher meat is, first it must come from a kosher animal, which doesn't mean it has to be raised any particular way. It just means it has to be an animal like a cow or a goat or a sheep or a giraffe, yes, that chews its cud and has a split hoof. That animal is kosher. Then it has to be killed a special way by a trained person with a knife. Then it becomes kosher. All right. Glatt kosher meat means that the lungs of the animal, when it is examined after the slaughter, have to be completely smooth. There cannot be any scarring on the lungs or what they call adhesions, which are little growths that could indicate the animal had pneumonia or a particular kind of disease. Now, it's true. Most of the people who buy kosher food in America on purpose buy it because they believe it's safer. Now, it's true that kosher meat cannot come from a downer animal, cannot come from an animal that is sick. If the animal is sick, the kosher slaughterer will not slaughter it if it's visibly sick in any way, and that includes sneezing, having a cold, anything. So there is something behind this idea. Glatt kosher, the word glatt means smooth, and it means the lungs are completely smooth. So this was a stricter level of kosher meat that came over from the Hungarian ultra-Orthodox Satmar Jews when they came to America in 1956 after the Hungarian Revolution. They brought this idea of ultra-Orthodox glatt meat to America, and they started to tell other ultra-Orthodox Jews, your meat isn't kosher enough for us. As America itself became more religious over the last 50 years, and yes, America is becoming more religious, and as each religious group became more fundamentalist and more strict, and the Orthodox movement in America has become more strict over the last 25, 30 years, more and more Jews who keep kosher began demanding this glatt level of kosher meat, and it snowballed. Butchers saw that their customers were demanding it, so then they would no longer accept non-glatt but still kosher meat from the slaughterhouses. And then so the slaughterhouses began demanding that the slaughterer examine every animal and only accept the ones with the completely smooth lungs. So what this means is that more and more animals who are kosher slaughtered are not accepted as kosher meat, and they have to be sold to non-kosher food processors afterwards. So the kosher meat industry cannot exist in this country without the non-kosher meat industry as well, because you have to have somewhere to sell your animals that aren't accepted as glatt kosher. And in addition to that, in this country, only the front half of every kosher animal can be sold as kosher meat. The back half is not kosher, and that's where a lot of the good cuts are, and they have to be, that meat has to be sold to non-kosher retail outlets as well. If you walk through Orthodox neighborhoods, you'll see the restaurants will say glatt kosher, you know, more and more often, and people think it just means extra kosher. And my favorite is when you see signs for glatt kosher dairy restaurants, right? Because glatt only has to do with meat, and that's my absolute favorite. I've taken some pictures of those places. Yeah, right. Because chicken, you don't have to check. There's no such thing as a glatt chicken, according to rabbinic law.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Our guest in the first part of the program was editor-in-chief of Tablet magazine, Alana Newhouse, whose new book is The 100 Most Jewish Foods, A Highly Debatable List. And our guest in the last part of the program was journalist and editor of J, the Jewish News of Northern California, Sue Fishkoff, whose book is Kosher Nation, Why More and More of America's Food Answers to a Higher Authority. The recording engineers of the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espelay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.